I'm Chuck Osborne.
And I'm Michael Smith. Welcome to our podcast, which is presented by Assured Partners Investment Advisors,
where we talk investing and all things related in a way you can understand.
Woohoo!
Hi, this is Chuck.
This is Michael. It's Tuesday, October 7th, 2025. This is the 23rd episode of our podcast.
Woo-hoo!
Chuck, what is on your mind?
Gold, Michael. There's gold in them there hills. So commodities have been the best place to be this year. And with that being the case, I thought that we should actually bring somebody on board that actually knows a little something about commodities. So I'd like to introduce Wasif Latif to our viewers and listeners. He is the co-founder and the chief investment officer of Sarmaya Partners, which is a commodity-based boutique investment management firm, which you can access through an ETF. And he comes with a long career in the investment business. He was with Truist Wealth, Victory Capital, where he was head of investments solutions, USAA Asset Management. So Wasif, much like myself, have been around for a long time, and he knows a little bit about what he's talking about. So to lead off, my first question, I guess, would be to talk about why commodities now, and maybe if you could talk a little something about, I know you are familiar with the mega cycle. Some of our listeners and viewers may not be as familiar with what we mean by the mega cycle in commodities.
Thanks, Chuck. And Michael, thanks for having me. Really appreciate it. So the whole idea about what we're doing is to think about the secular themes or the secular cycles, as you mentioned, Chuck, as they evolve and unfold. And it really is every major market cycle, if you look back in time, going back not only 100 years, but even prior to that, there's always been some kind of a secular theme that's dominated that market cycle, and that significantly does better than the broader market whenever that is in play. And so our focus is to think about what is the next big secular cycle or the secular theme, as we're calling it, and build a portfolio that's focused on that and a concentrated portfolio looking at just that space and then trying to outperform the market over that secular time period. So specifically, we think that this new secular cycle has already started. It started in about 2021 after the lockdowns of the pandemic were being unwound and people were coming out and going about their business. And we think that the next big cycle is a commodity super cycle that is still in the early innings and will take multiple years to really continue to do well and unfold. And our portfolio is based off of that, looking at that broader framework.
Well, so I have one question. You know, we're not going to be able to put these up, but you have some great charts in your book with talking through mm-hmm. these. And with the last few cycles, a lot of them seem to be practically dead bookend into the decades. And this current one, which looks like it's growth focused, tends to be, you know, it's longer. So I don't know if this is longer historically than cycles have gone, even past the last five that you looked at. But from me looking at it, I'm like, well, this is a much longer cycle. And maybe why you think that is, or any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a really good observation and a great question, Michael. So this particular secular cycle that we have been in, which we think we're close to maturing and will eventually end, has been very, very long, which is looking at large cap growth. Prior cycles generally tend to rhyme with decades. They're not precisely aligned with decades, but there's generally, some kind of an alignment to that. And the chart that you're referring to looks back at least the last 5-6 decades. So in the 70s, it was oil and gold that really was the secular theme that drove returns higher, brought up more than anything else in the market. In the 1980s, it was Japan and so on and so forth. And since the great financial crisis, pretty much since 2009, 2010, we've been in this large cap growth technology type of a secular cycle that has been the leader in driving the market for a long period of time. And when you look back in history, it has been a much, much longer cycle than prior ones. But our work tells us two things. One, no cycle lasts forever and goes to the moon. Eventually, every cycle eventually declines, and we think this one will as well. It has been more prolonged than the other ones, probably because of two things. One, the severity of the financial crisis was so deep that it took a long time for this cycle to really kick into gear. So because of it so deep and so prolonged, we think that the recovery of that took a long time just to get going. And now you're in sort of the frothier part of it, in our opinion. The other reason is continues to be a lot of liquidity and policy-driven support for the broader market in general, which is tending to help this space, as well as some of the mechanics of the new tools that are available to investors in terms of broader ETFs, leverage ETFs, and other kind of tools that are continuing to push this market higher and keep sort of the buy the dip type of a psychology moving. And so we think that that's some of the reasons why this is longer than the ones in the past. But that also means that maybe the decline of this might be longer as well because of some of the excesses that are built into this space, in our opinion. And what is most interesting to us is every one of these secular cycles or themes, when they are in their maturity phase, the new one begins in its shadows. And so we think that the commodity secular theme, which we are calling the return to tangibles, and there's a reason for that, we can get into that, but ultimately, it's about refocusing investors and the world back to the importance of physical commodities, the ugly, dirty, grimy commodities that we thought we were past in this new digital world over the past decade. We think that the world is now waking up or has woken up to the idea that we still need them. They're the foundation of everything that we have built, and we continue to need them to not only continue to having our lifestyles, but also to prosper. And now more recently, in order to make sure that we have them from a strategic and a national priority standpoint as well. So that cycle, in our view, began in 2021, as I mentioned earlier. And we can get into sort of the catalyst and why now. But that has in our view, what started, and it's still in the early innings, because when these cycles begin, they generally tend to last multiple years. And in our view, this is going to be a multi-year secular cycle.
Yeah. So, well, see, if you could, just for the sake of, our listeners and our viewers. So when you started talking about the mega cycles, you talked about the 70s and gold being the dominant play in the 70s and commodities in general for multiple reasons. Then the 80s, we had Japan. And then you kind of said, and so on. And of course, Michael and I know exactly what happened in the 90s and the aughts. Sure. But I think it might be a good catch up for some of our viewers because, the cycle in the 90s is very similar to the cycle that we've been through in terms of what the leadership was recently. And what you're suggesting is also very similar to what actually happened in the aughts. Would you, agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. So just as a quick backdrop, in the 70s, as I mentioned, it was oil and gold. And that was really driven by the environment of stagflation and the coming off of the gold standard and a variety of different geopolitical events as well that unfolded during that period. And that fed that cycle. In the 1980s, Japan was coming out and really becoming a global economy of significance. And that helped alongside the Plaza Accord that took place, which significantly boosted the value of the yen versus the dollar. And all of that contributed to the Japanese market being the best performer in the world during the 1980s, which peaked literally in the end of 1989. And since then has struggled to get back to those levels. And then in the 1990s, as we know, in the second half of the 90s, because the internet really became at the forefront of technology and our usage, and began to get more and more adoption in our day-to-day lives, whether it was productivity through work, but also through our other general lives, that became the driver of the market in terms of the dot-com companies, in terms of the infrastructure companies that laid the cable and the fiber optics to get the internet data transmitted from one corner of the world to the other corner of the world. So that drove the market in the 90s. And in the 2000s, in the aughts, it was all about commodities because China joined the WTO in 99 and effectively began its journey to becoming the factory of the world. And in order to do so, it was importing a tremendous amount of commodities across the board, not only to return them into finished goods to send to the rest of the world, but also to build its infrastructure. And we saw what that decade did. So, and we talked about the big mega cap tech theme since the financial crisis. So when we look at the world today, to us, it looks like a combination of a couple of things from these cycles in the past. When we talk about gold, gold seems to be reflecting a combination of what we saw in the 70s and in the 2000s, where you had a greater degree of buying from overseas markets. In those days, it was retail investors. Now it's global central banks, and they're buying it for geopolitical reasons. They're trying to diversify their U.S. dollar holdings and getting more into gold. And then also in the 70s, you had the stagflation that really pushed gold higher because of the loss of purchasing power and the debasement of the fiat currency, especially when we went off the gold standard. And now you're seeing this fear of currency debasement, not only in the US dollar, but across the board in many currencies. And that really is born out of the high levels of sovereign debt and the deficits that are continuing to run, not only in the US, but also in most developing, almost developed countries. And so you're getting a combination of the 70s and the 2000s in especially gold. And the broader side, you had mentioned the 1990s, what's reflective in the current mega cap tech cycle is very similar to what occurred in the 90s. The frothiness and valuations, but also the high expectations and the linear calculations that investors and some strategists are making, that we will run out of the data center capacity because we're going to need it. And there's going to be so much need for energy. There's going to be so much need for all of this data center capacity. And it's a linear calculation they're doing. And because of that, the amount of CapEx that's going into those that infrastructure build out is very reminiscent of the late 90s build out of the fiber optic and the cable capacity. Back in those days, the idea was we're going to run out of capacity. We're going to have so much data through the internet that's going to be going back and forth around the world that we cannot lay down enough cable, enough fiber optic infrastructure. And what is ironic is that to this day, we still haven't yet reached that capacity completely. And the reason is innovation. The reason is technological advancement. And when you think about things linearly, when you look at a point today and look at something in the future and draw a straight line, you're not accounting for technological innovation. You're not accounting for all kinds of improvements that take place. So in our view, there could be, and there likely will be, continual advancements in technological processes and innovations and usage of energy and cooling of servers that will drive that efficiency lower, and which means that there's a risk that we have been involved in, or the market is now investing in too much overbuild of that capacity. We'll only know that for sure, but it is very eerily reminiscent of that era. And so to us, that means that that might be the final nail that contributes to the decline of this mega cap tech cycle, because now those companies that used to be asset light and cash flow rich are now becoming asset heavy, and they're putting a lot of CapEx in there. And we still don't see light at the end of the tunnel on how they're going to be able to monetize and be able to capitalize on all of that investment and not only make that money back, but then make more profit on top of it. So those question marks remain. In the meantime, what's more important to us is that the opportunities in the commodity space, whether it's gold mining companies, silver mining companies, platinum mining companies, and iron ore companies, all of those are ripe for growth given what's going on both on the macro front, whether it's geopolitical or inflationary, but also in terms of the policy that's happening and the incentives in that space. Even just today, there was news about a strategic position that the U.S. government has taken in a material company. And so all that's going to contribute. So to us, that's where the opportunity is, especially when the valuations are still attractive, the cash flows are really strong. And as the commodity prices rise, the profitability of these companies will continue to go up.
So you hit on something there, Wasif, that is, I think, is the kind of the next big question we have. So we've got this, you know, mega cycle and the potential that we are moving into tangibles, much like we did in the aughts. But if what is the actual best way to take advantage of that and to actually invest in commodities? Is it like actually owning the commodity itself? Is it futures contracts? You know, I'd love to get your view on managed futures. Or as you suggested, is it actually buying the miners, the companies that are in the commodity business?
Yeah, that's the most important $64,000 question. That's really where the rubber meets the road. And so I'm really glad you asked that question. So in our view, the better way to play it is through equities. And I'll talk about why. So on investing directly into the commodities, when you're doing it through futures or an ETF that's trying to invest in the futures, even on a index basis, or trying to play the futures curve and the interest rate curve, all of that stuff is mean reverting in a lot of ways over time. So I've been an asset allocator in my prior life for the better part of 25 years. And much like yourself, Chuck and Mike, you know, we've looked at portfolios from an asset allocation perspective. And when you look at commodities as an asset class, it is something that is challenging on a strategic basis because it tends to mean revert over that time horizon, which can be 20 to 30 year period. Yeah. However, in the near term tactical time horizon, which can be anywhere between 3 to 5 to 10 years, that becomes a really interesting space to invest in when you hit the cycle right. When you get into it, when those commodities are moving up, that is the best timing to be tactically in that space and overweight that space. This, and even within that, the commodities themselves, they generally tend to be a lot more volatile and don't have the degree of return that you can get with equities. And why is that? Because equities are companies that are involved in that space. So they're either exploring for or mining or extracting or selling or facilitating through services some part of that commodity cycle. And because of their management capabilities, their financial leverage, and their operating leverage, they're able to actually generate a profit and a return, which then can compound and provide some degree of understanding and ability for us as investors to look at and say, here's a cash flow, here's what I can discount, and here's the earnings potential, and that gives me comfort. And historically, not only is it better from that standpoint, it actually shows that the equity side generally tends to perform better than the commodity over time, but especially in this bull market because of that very reason of financial and operating leverage. One caveat I would make is when it comes to gold and silver, because they're seen as a precious metal, especially gold, it is a haven asset. It is seen as a tier one asset in not only times of stress, but in times of inflation and stagflation and times of geopolitical risk. And over the arc of history, over the course of time, gold tends to hold its value. And we think of that as its own category or its own creature within commodities. So in our portfolio, we do have an allocation directly to gold and a little bit to silver. And we have gold mining stocks and silver stocks because they tend to have all that leverage that I just mentioned. All of the other exposures, because they're more industrial in nature and can have that back and forth and mean reversion in the commodity, we tend to play through the actual companies. And that's not just for metals. It also is for energy. So we have oil and gas companies in our portfolio, and we would rather play it through those companies as opposed to investing in oil futures, for example.
Yeah. Was it one of the hottest places to be is anything connected to uranium lately, right?
Yeah.
Like that everybody wants to talk about. Like, how do you think about that in this world? And how do you try to play that? Does that make sense to you from your framework?
Yeah, it absolutely does. So we've owned one of those largest uranium mining companies for years in our portfolio. And it's been a great, great holding. It's done extremely well. Just a quick bit of history for your viewers and your listeners. There have been bookended disasters when it comes to nuclear technology. So the last major one was in 2011, the Fukushima disaster based off of the tsunami. And that sent a lot of fear and shockwaves through this space, and the price of uranium collapsed with the idea that over time, the world will start phasing out nuclear energy for generating power. And that did occur in a lot of Western countries and developed countries where they began to phase that out. Fast forward to about 2020 is when it looked like the price of uranium had dropped to a level where the demand was going to significantly outstrip that supply. And that just meant that the commodity was now at a point where it could get into the next big cycle. And as I mentioned, these cycles, when they start, they tend to last multiple years. And so we got really excited. We put money into a uranium mining company, and it's been a great investment for us since then. Yeah. What has happened since that period are two important things. Number one, the world has realized that the need for energy is only going to continue to grow. Since we have a chart that I show usually, which shows the global use of energy since the 1960s, and it has done nothing but go up. And that is like all different kinds of energy together. And oil, gas, and nuclear are a big part of that. And so as that continues to grow, and the idea that with this AI technology boom, we're going to need a lot more energy. And the technology companies are looking more for a clean energy solution as opposed to getting into oil. And so what has happened is they have, over the last year, put money into this space. They're either contracting with nuclear power plants or outright getting into that space and investing in it. And that's given an extra boost to that space. But what has happened is, in our view, the nuclear uranium trade seems to have been subsumed by this AI tech boom and this AI tech trade to the point where some of the names are becoming pretty frothy. And in some cases, you have names that are out there where companies actually don't even make money, and some of the technology is yet to be proven. So we'd rather play it through the foundational bottom line commodity, which is uranium. And we still have that exposure in the portfolio. And we think that at some point there's going to be an air pocket And some of these names are going to feel some pressure. And at that point, we would look to add more to the uranium directly. We'd rather own the stuff that the picks and shovels are actually picking up in this space, as opposed to just the picks and shovels that everybody's been talking about. So uranium for us is the right way to play it. And the last piece is, you mentioned uranium and nuclear. The other thing is that with the growth in the need for energy in this new era of AI and data centers, because nuclear takes a long time to come online, even though they're getting into this space, they're contracting with these companies, the energy really hasn't been produced yet from nuclear. So in the meantime, where are they going? They're going to natural gas. So natural gas has become a good source for them, which is relatively clean, and they're still getting that exposure. So natural gas names have done well, and we have a good allocation of natural gas names in our portfolio, not only for that reason, but also on a longer term structural basis. Unlike oil, which is a global market, oil, if anything happens around the world, the price adjusts globally everywhere. Natural gas is still a local market. So the price of natural gas in Europe versus Asia versus the US are different prices. And we are now beginning the journey of turning that local market into a global market. So you're going to see this convergence in natural gas prices, and the net beneficiaries of that will be the U.S. producers, because they're going to figure out, and they're in the process of getting more and more natural gas liquefied and into overseas markets. And that's going to help with this market becoming a more global market. And that, in our view, that convergence will help the U.S. producers more.
Yeah. One last question I have, Wazif, and how this plays on the this whole cycle theme, because everything you said makes a lot of sense to me. Mm-hmm. Do you think there is a role that the tariffs are playing and the interplay there, and how that might lead to inflation or does it lead to inflation? What's your view on that?
That's a really good question. Sorry.
Go ahead and put on top of that too, how that impacts growth as well, because I know part of your theme is both there's higher growth and there's higher inflation. Tariff complicates that. So I think that's an interesting thing to think through.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I've been making this point recently that, you have some investors or strategists saying tariffs are inflationary. And then you have some folks saying, no, they're deflationary. And our view is that it's a bit of both. And the reason is it really depends on what the consumption basket is. Our daily lives, the stuff that we consume, a lot of it does come from overseas. So that in itself is likely to be inflationary, in that the tariffs will push those prices higher as the cost of those tariffs are pushed to the consumers. So far, the data is showing that it's been a third, a third, a third. So one third of the cost is being assumed by the producer, one third by the U.S. importer and the seller here, and about a third of it is being consumed by or absorbed by the final consumer. So it is at the margin inflationary to think about tariffs in general, because they're subject, those are made at the goods level. What might be deflationary might be, certain consumption things are not necessary or necessities, and that might decline and those prices might not rise as much. But net to us, there is an inflationary impulse and an inflationary impact to tariffs. Now, when you put that within the backdrop of an economy that might be slowing, because if companies are losing or seeing less profit on their imports and their margins are going to get squeezed, at the same time, if employment begins to soften, you could get a situation where the economy is actually turning a little bit soft, where the prices are rising because it's import price inflation. And that is before oil really has had a significant rally upward. We think that oil is a coil spring and it will have this bounce up, because the market is ignoring or complacent about the supply versus demand dynamics, and we think that at some point that's going to show up in the price. And so when that happens, you could get a stagflationary shock, which would, in our view, be very, very impactful to the broader market, because rates will need to rise and reflect that. Whereas stagflation historically has shown, just like in the 70s, it was really good for gold, and it was actually very good for energy stocks and energy companies as well. So we think that that's going to be something that plays out in the portfolio, in our portfolio as well. I don't know if that answered the question. Did I? I'm not sure if I missed any part of that.
Yeah, it, I mean, it did. I think that spells your view. I guess I would just push back on that just a little bit, because so if you look at the basket of goods that the U.S. consumes, 15% come from overseas. So, you know, 85% of GDP is spent here domestically. 15% is spent from things that are coming in. And I guess the question is, if prices go up on those items, is that actually enough to create inflation? Because as you said, there are going to be some items where there's easy replacements, and or there, and so you know, the consumer will just simply switch and buy this product B instead of product A because the price of product A went up. And so those producers are not going to be able to pass along the tariff to the consumer and still sell their product. There are going to be some products, as you said, where they are going to be able to pass it on, or at least part of it on. And so those prices will go up. But, you know, individual prices going up is not the same thing as the economy as a whole experiencing inflation. So so I don't know if you have a response to that, or if you, I guess it's just your view that you think that it is going to be enough to cause inflation as a whole.
Yeah, so I would say our broad big picture view is that we remain in an era of high inflation, and we don't think we have seen the end of inflation yet. There's a chart that I show that tracks inflation now in this period to the 70s, and it's right. Eerily familiar. And so inflation tends to be, I use this phrase cheekily, but, you know, a spike in inflation is like a cockroach. There's usually not just one, there's going to be more. And right. so we think that there's going to be another spike. And to answer your question, what will drive that? I think it will be the goods basket. I totally agree. And that's why I mentioned earlier that it is a mixed bag. It's not a completely one-sided driver of higher inflation. And the goods basket is not as significant as the services basket is, or the housing basket is. So I think there'll be trade-offs, and there's going to be a mixed result in a lot of those. But ultimately, being a services economy, I think wage pressure and services pricing pressure might continue to push inflation higher. And as I mentioned earlier, we think that there's a chance that perhaps not this year, but sometime next year, you see a re-rating in the price of oil because of the complacency and the misunderstanding that we think is happening in the market vis-a-vis the actual supply that might be coming over the next year or two versus the demand that continues to grow, not just in the US, but overseas as well. The increase in energy usage is much, much so in the developing countries, in the non-OECD countries, and they, at the margin, might continue to push the demand for that. And so so our view is that that is something that's going to be a universal push upward in energy, which will drive inflation higher. So I think tariffs by themselves are a mixed bag, and you're going to get a little bit of each, but they will impact consumption. And that could be the cause for a slowing of the economy, but that doesn't necessarily mean that all prices will go down. So in our view, we're going to get another a spike in inflation. We just don't know exactly how that will transpire, but we think the mix is going to be a combination of wage inflation, perhaps a medical price inflation, given the demographics around the country, And then combine that with an energy rise in energy costs. So all that, in our view, will contribute to inflation. And lastly, with the labor market still fairly tight, the supply of labor being less than what it used to be a few years ago, and at the same time, the Fed is cutting interest rates, we think that also will provide an impetus for higher inflation. So we are in inflationistas, if you will, and we think that we haven't seen the highs of this cycle yet, similar to the 1970s. So I'll end with this, that I typically use this phrase. Some of my business partners, they roll their eyes when they say it, but I will say it anyway, is that we better get our bell bottoms up because we're going back to the 70s.
I'll just say that I am not worried about wearing bell bottoms. If my sister is listening in Texas, I'm not pushing her car to the gas station again like I did. in the fuel lines of the 1970s. Thank you very much for your time. This has been very interesting. If people do want to learn more about Sarmaya Partners, where can they find you?
Yeah, our website is the best place. It's sarmayapartners.com. Alternatively, they can check out our ETF at sarmayaetf.com. And I'm available on Twitter and on Substack if anybody would like to get in touch directly.
That sounds great. And I'll also just end with, for all of our viewers and listeners, if you like this information, please do take the moment to subscribe and, you know, share with your friends and do all those fun social media things that help spread the word. And I think that point is a good place to stop. What do you think, Michael?
I think that's perfect. Yeah. We'll talk to you guys later.
Chuck Osborne and Michael Smith are investment advisors, representative of Assured Partners Investment Advisors, LLC, a registered investment advisor. All statements and opinions expressed in this program are based upon information considered reliable, although statements or opinions are subject to change without notice. Information expressed does not consider the specific situation or objectives of any person and is not intended as a recommendation appropriate for any person. Viewers are encouraged to seek advice from a tax or legal professional or investment advisor to determine whether any information presented may be suitable for their specific situation. Information presented is for educational purposes only and does not intend to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies. Investments involve risk, and unless otherwise stated, are not guaranteed.